Sermon for this morning. We're looking at the elements, the events surrounding the arrest and crucifixion of Jesus Christ. We joined him and the 12 in the upper room, starting back in chapter 17, as they celebrated the Passover meal together. As they observed that meal, Jesus began a series of teachings that got more and more profound as the evening progressed, as the evening developed. The teachings got deeper and deeper. He began the evening by washing the feet of his disciples. It was another profound move. He even washed the feet of Jesus, who would betray Judas, who would betray him. And Judas left the meeting to go betray him. The group eventually left the upper room. They started moving through Jerusalem. They were on their way around the temple and across the Kidron Valley to go to the Garden of Gethsemane. And all the way they went, Jesus was teaching them. And the teachings just got deeper and deeper and deeper. And Jesus was revealing more and more about who he was and what he came to do and how it was going to roll out. And he kept on telling the disciples that he was going to leave and he would send a comforter and that he would protect them and equip them. And they didn't understand it at the time, but he even explained that they would understand it soon. So the group eventually got to the Garden of Gethsemane, where Judas showed up with about 500 armed Roman soldiers. A cohort is 460 or better. And they took Jesus captive. Jesus was trying to protect his disciples. He had them leave them behind. They did. They were still safe. And as the soldiers approached, as they saw them coming down to this group and realized they were coming after them, we saw this tension. We saw this incredible tension between the way Jesus reacted to that situation and the way Peter reacted to the situation. Jesus was doing the will of the Father. He was in the middle of a very difficult set of circumstances, and he was submitting to the Father. Peter was trying to take things into his own hand. He was trying to control. He was doing what he thought needed to be done and nobody else was doing. So Peter's reaction was full of self-assertion. It was maybe perhaps a bit prideful. It was filled with impatience at dealing with the circumstances that he was in. Jesus' reaction was peace. It was compassion for those around him. It was a knowledge that his Father was in control, not just of him, not just of the disciples, but his Father was in control of the Roman cohort, all 500 of those armed soldiers. His Father was in control, even of Judas, who was going to betray him. So today, we're going to see what happens next. And, you know, there's seemingly a tragic sequence of events here. But we're going to take a look at it. We've already seen the betrayal. Today, we're going to look at three denials, and we'll look at the beginning of a trial. And I'm going to put trial in quotation marks here, and you'll understand why I do that in just a little bit, because it's just the beginning of everything. In the middle of all that, I want to show you that that tension between Christ and Peter still exists. That tension between how Jesus faces the situation and how Peter deals with it. And even in the middle of that, I want to show you the incredible, amazing grace that Christ just allows to flow from him with every step through this scenario. So our sermon today is Betrayed, Denied, and Tried, Part 2. This is Part 54 of our ongoing series, Light in the Darkness in the Gospel of John. We'll do 55 next week, and that'll be part 3 of Betrayed, Denied, and Tried. So let's take a look at verse 12, where Jesus has been taken captive. He's been put under arrest. The text isn't clear as to why Jesus is bound, and people want to make a lot out of this. You know, it may be just the way they arrested people back then. There's just no explanation for it. There's no precedence for it. It's kind of like for all of those of you who have been arrested. Everybody's been in jail. Raise your hand. No, wait. I have heard that when you get arrested, they put handcuffs on you and put you in the back of a police car. It may be similar to what we have happening here. But it may be, it just may be that the Roman cohort is reacting in fear. The fear that they experienced when Jesus said, I am He. If you remember when He said, I am He, He did it in such a manner that it was the same type of proclamation that He made when He said, when Abraham was, I am. It was ego a me. It was the language of God. It was the language of divinity. And the soldiers all fell down to the ground when He said it the way He said it. So they may be reacting to that and thinking, we better tie this guy up. We don't know what's going on here. So they take him to Hanas. And we see in verse 13 that Hanas was the high priest before Caiaphas. Caiaphas is his son-in-law, and as such, he was well-respected. He still had power. He still had some recognition. They would view him kind of the way that we would look at an ex-president, somebody whose advice, somebody whose input was valuable, somebody we would want to have a high regard for. So we should note that John doesn't really say in here where Hanas is. Now, this is important, and it could come in handy. If you're trying to harmonize the Gospels, if you're trying to go through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John together, we already know that John doesn't do things in chronological order. He tells his story. Making his point is more important to him than getting the order of events right. So if you're trying to harmonize the Gospels, it could be a little bit difficult trying to go step by step through all four of them. John doesn't really say where Hanas is. And nor does he tell us why they visit Hanas first. And that's kind of important to understand as well. Because this is an unusual situation. What begins to roll out here is not the official examination of Jesus. It's not the official examination that the Jewish law would require to occur prior to a trial. As far as Caiaphas is concerned, what we learned in the next verse, and this kind of funnels into everything that's going on, Caiaphas would just assume that he died. Because we had already heard a little while ago that Caiaphas is the one who unknowingly prophesied that it's better for one man to die for all the people. So Caiaphas, who is the high priest now, is looking towards having Jesus executed. So Hanas is in the mix here. Meanwhile, we see this in verse 15. Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. We see that Peter didn't abandon Christ. He didn't run and hide the way the other 10 did. He followed Jesus, and so did another. So who is this other? Well, a lot of folks assume that the other one that followed is the disciple John. I don't think that's true. If you take a look at the situation, it's highly unlikely that John would have a close enough relationship with the high priest that he would be accorded special privileges. He would just be allowed to pass through the door in a moment that was rife with tension. I don't think it was John. I don't think John that would be well known enough that whoever was at the door would just let him through. I think this is either Nicodemus or Joseph of Arimathea. Either way, we don't really know. John's not specific about it. I think the only reason that he mentions it is by way of making a way for Peter to get in the courtyard. And that's what we see in the next verse, in 16. But Peter stood outside at the door, so the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. So we see Peter following the action. Now, I've talked about this before. I think Peter gets a bad rap in a lot of things that happen in the New Testament, because we get this idea of Peter being impulsive, and he certainly was that. But I think sometimes we condemn Peter for things we should be a bit more careful about. It seems to me that Peter is the bravest of the 11 that are left. He knows Jesus is under arrest. He is just he just cut off the ear of a high-ranking official, somebody who was close to the high priest. He's literally risking his life to be close to Jesus. We need to think about that for a second. Peter is risking his life to be close to Jesus. And that led me, as I looked at this, to ask myself a crucial question. Would I be so brave as to follow Jesus regardless of the cost? Are you brave enough to follow Jesus regardless of the cost? How many of us would risk everything just to be closer to Jesus Christ? Yes, Peter was impulsive. But you know something? Peter was loyal. Peter was committed. He kind of had it together. But the reality was that Peter was also human. He was as human as you and I are. Look what happens when he enters the courtyard in verse 17. The servant girl at the door said to Peter, "You also are not one of this man's disciples, are you?" And he said, "I am not." Peter said, "I am not." The girl at the door has some suspicions about Peter, so she confronts him. Now, I want to look at this the way Peter sees it. Peter's aware of the risk. He knew what he was doing. But something happens here in this moment. Something unexpected. Perhaps Peter is startled that a young girl, and this is a relatively young girl, probably a teenage girl, would be bold enough to ask him a question in such a manner that it demanded an answer from him. This is more of an accusation than it is a question. Whatever the reason, we see the first denial. Peter denies being a disciple. He says, "I am not." Unexpected events can shake us up, can't they? They can derail us. Particularly if they come at exactly the wrong time. You know, most of us have learned to dance out there on the edge pretty well, keeping our balance when the hair's breadth one way or the other. A lot of us can do that. But things can happen that can upset that balance. We can get thrown off edge by an untimely surprise. A surprise can cause us to panic. We start asking our questions, well, what happens now? How much worse is this going to get? I wasn't planning on this. What will I do? I don't think I can take any more. If one more thing happens, I'm going to cave here. Have you ever felt that way? Sometimes life moves in on us unexpectedly. And it happens in a manner that throws us off balance. I think that's what happened to Peter here. That moment can cause us to fear. It can rob us of our joy. It can cause doubt. That's what happened to Peter, isn't it? He's under all this stress. He really, really wants to do the right thing. He's literally doing everything he can to cope with the situation and make the best of it. And he's walking through the door. He can see into the courtyard. He knows that's where he wants to be. He can probably see Jesus Christ. He's not really thinking much about the door. I'm not thinking much about the girl standing at the door. And she turns to him and she goes, "You're one of them, aren't you?" And he panics. He loses his resolve. And he denies being a follower of Christ. There's the tension. There's the tension in the passage. Earlier, Christ goes with the guards. He goes calmly. He knows where they're taking him. He knows he's headed for the cross. He knows he's headed for suffering. He knows all that. Yet he goes calmly. Peter tries to take charge. And now Jesus is under arrest, still acting calmly as far as we can tell. Peter is anything but calm, knowing that this girl has undone him. He doesn't know how to handle the situation. He sounds fragile and afraid, doesn't he? Peter. So he scurries away and he heads for the fire where some of the servants and some of the officers are warming their hands. He just kind of upped the ante a little bit, didn't he? Meanwhile, Jesus is standing in front of Hannas, who begins to examine him about what? About his followers and his teaching. Hannas' behavior is getting even more unusual. Jesus was under arrest. He was entitled to a trial. But under Jewish law, it was up to the accusers to produce witnesses that would testify to the criminal behavior of the one on trial. It was actually illegal for Hannas to question Jesus. That wasn't how it worked. The witnesses would come in. They would make their case. Jesus would defend himself. But this wasn't a formal trial. At least it isn't yet. Hannas seems to have free rein to do whatever he wants to do here. His questions cover two areas, if you look at this closely. His followers, perhaps, well, indeed, there is a concern for the size of his movement. Bear in mind that keeping the peace was vitally important. We all understand that. Nobody wanted to upset the things with the Romans. Was Jesus here to upset that apple cart? Were there enough people following him? How passionate were they? How committed were they? Is Jesus inciting his followers to do something radical? There was a serious problem here, and the Jews wanted to deal with it before it got out of hand. The second thing that Hannas asked about him was his teaching. Exactly what was he teaching his followers? Now, Hannas would have been aware of the core of Jesus' teaching. He would have been informed of that. He would have known that Jesus was running around saying he was the Son of God. And Hannas would have known there was a problem with that. So this area, this second area of questioning is a theological area. The first one is a logistical area. The second one is a theological area. Later, when the leaders would go to Pilate, they would tell him their problem, their issue was political. But their real concern is the theological foundation of what Jesus is teaching and how widely he has spread this doctrine. And how fanatical were the ones who were following him? How fanatically did they embrace the doctrine? If Jesus would answer all of these questions the way Hannas expected him to answer it, the Sanhedrin would have all it needed to try Jesus and convict him of heresy and blasphemy. And now, if we understand that, we understand what's really happening here. Why Hannas is acting so mysteriously and Jesus seems to be taking different places out of the order of the way things should go. Hannas was the interrogator. He was the guy that worked in the back room. He was the guy that functioned off the record. His job was to get the evidence that they needed to convict Jesus and do anything he could do to get it. Jesus understands exactly what's going on. He refuses to be part of that subterfuge. Jesus knows what's in store for him. He knows where all this is going in. But he's not going to play these games with these people. He's not going to compromise his integrity. He's not going to find himself in disobedience to the law for how a trial would be conducted. What's being done is illegal and he'll have no part of it. In verse 20, Jesus said to Hannas, I've spoken openly to the world. I've always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together. I've said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I said. There are no plots. There's no conspiracies here. Jesus has been open and above board in everything he's done, everything he said. It's interesting that even as we look at that, there's no indication that when Hannas said, tell us about your followers, tell us about your teachers, that he had to stop and consider what he's been teaching and what he's been saying. He doesn't have to pause and think back and go over the things he said. There's no chance that he's done anything wrong. All he's ever done is spoken the truth. If we find ourselves in a situation where all we've ever done is spoken the truth, we don't have to worry about covering up lies. In Jesus' life, there's no lie to cover up. There's no deception to reconcile. There's nothing to explain. There's nothing to justify. All he's done is taught the truth. Jesus says, literally, why are we doing this? I know that you're going to try me. I've been open and public about everything I've said and done. Let's do this the right way. Where are your witnesses? They're going to be the ones that give the testimony that will either convict me or acquit me. Isn't that the law? Isn't that the law that Moses gave you? Isn't that the law that my Father in heaven gave you? Why aren't we doing that? Notice this. That in his response,
Jesus never answers the question about his followers. He never talks about them. Here he is. He's knowing that they're plotting to kill him. And he's still protecting the disciples. He's still preserving them. He's still sheltering them. He's still making sure that they're able to carry on after he leaves, just like he promised them he would do. Well, it's not enough that they were just questioning him illegally. One of the officers there, taking offense at the tone he hears, or whatever is going on with Hanas, strikes him. This is illegal as well. Look at how Jesus responds in verse 23. If what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. If what I said is right, why do you strike me? This is hardly... You know, one of the teachings we get from the Bible is to turn the other cheek, isn't it? This is hardly a turn the other cheek moment. And we could look at this and go, how come he's not turning the other cheek? We could look at this and compare it to what happened between Paul and Ananias in chapter 23 of Acts. Paul is before Ananias. Ananias is questioning Paul. Paul didn't like the direction the question is going in. He says something. Ananias commands that Paul be struck. Paul's struck. He calls Ananias a whitewashed sepulcher. And the guard looks at him and goes, how dare you talk to the chief priest like that? And Paul goes, wait a minute, I didn't know he was the chief priest. Excuse me. Paul apologizes. He kind of backpedals on all that. As far as Paul was concerned, his situation involved a formal trial. He was in the middle of a formal legal proceeding. And he reacted initially in an inappropriate way. When he was informed of the fact that his actions were inappropriate, he apologized. He said he was sorry. That's not right. As far as Jesus is concerned, and as far as him turning the other cheek or apologizing for what's going on here, well, we all know where this is headed. The whole situation is headed towards the greatest turn-the-cheek event ever in the history of mankind, the cross. So we know that Jesus is true to what he says, true to his nature and character. So what's going on here in verse 23? If you look at this carefully, you see that Jesus is merely saying, if I lied, where are your witnesses? You seem to be unable to prove that I lied. So if I've told the truth, why are you striking me? Now there's something underneath here that we need to see. Jesus is not being belligerent. He's trying to help them understand that they have presented no case against him. He will allow them to rescue him, to arrest him. He will allow them to torture him. He will allow them to sentence him unjustly. He will allow them to attempt to murder him. He will, in every sense, turn the other cheek, but not at the expense of the truth. He's not going to give up the truth to allow all that to happen. He will speak truth at every turn. He is the truth. He can't help but speak the truth. If convicted, his conviction will be based on their lies, not on his. And he's going to point that out with every opportunity he gets. You see, his conviction will say more about those who have judged him than it will say about him. He's truth. And everything that stands against him is a lie. And this whole trial, every step of the way, will do nothing more than expose the desperate need that the Sanhedrin has for salvation. You see what's happening here? Jesus calmly, resolutely reminds them that what they're doing is wrong. Even by their own standards, it's wrong. And in reality, Jesus has given them every step of the way, every time he's had an encounter with the Pharisees, with the Sadducees, with the Sanhedrin, he's given them every opportunity to repent. This is another opportunity to repent before things go too far. He shows them their sin. He gives them a chance to turn away from it. He gives them a chance to confess before it's too late. He's not arguing with them. Christ is witnessing to them. Christ is witnessing. Isn't that the gospel? We see our sin, we turn towards Christ. And once again, if we look at the big picture for this little scenario, we see that tension between Christ and between Peter and how they handle the situation. Peter's first reaction is aggressive self-defense. He cuts off an ear. That morphs into fear and a desperate sense of self-preservation, self-protection. Jesus willingly goes before his accusers, not to become some kind of passive victim, but to reveal their lies, to reveal their desperate need to be touched by the grace of God. Rescue them from their own depravity. He gives them every opportunity, but they refuse to listen. They refuse to hear. So Annas sends Jesus to Caiaphas. We'll find out what happens in front of Caiaphas next week. But meanwhile, let's go back and take a look at what's happening with Peter. While all this is going on, let me remind you what happened in chapter 13. Jesus told the disciples where he was going. Peter said, no, you don't have to do that. I'll follow you anywhere. Even if I have to give up my life, I'll follow you. And Jesus turns to Peter and says, truly, truly, I say to you, before the cock crows three times, you will deny me three. Before the cock crows, you will deny me three times tonight. It's an incredible time. Here in the courtyard, Peter's already denied him once. And while Jesus is being examined, this is what happens in verse 25. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. So they said to him, you also are not one of his disciples, are you? He denied it and said, I'm not. Blindsided by the girl. Finally in the courtyard, maybe thinking he made it in, Jesus is confronted. Peter is confronted again. And again, he denies being with Christ. This is the second denial. Jesus speaks nothing but the truth. Peter at this point is speaking nothing but lies. He's the other side of everything that's going on with Christ. And it's not over yet. In verse 26, one of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, did I not see you in the garden with him? Notice, with each accusation, everything went up another level. First it was the girl at the door, then it was the servants and the officers. Now it's a servant of the high priest and a relative of Malchus, the guy whose ear Peter cut off. And this man, this relative, was in the garden when it all happened. Didn't I see you in the garden? You can almost feel Peter's anxiety building throughout the entire situation. The closer he gets to Christ, the closer he gets to Christ, the more trouble he encounters. There's a mini life lesson for us right there in that. The closer Peter gets to Christ, the more determined he is to stay near, the more trouble he finds. The more resolve he has to follow Christ, the harder it gets for him to do so. You know, the world calls our faith a crutch, don't they? They make those accusations that we lean on it, that we rely on it. But the Bible tells us a completely different story about our faith. We're called to take up our cross. We're called to enter into his suffering. We're told that the world will hate us. We're told that the world will persecute us. All because of Jesus. That doesn't sound much like a crutch to me. Matter of fact, that sounds pretty tough to me. But even in that message, there's good news. Because we are also told that Jesus is the pearl of great price. That he is the prize that we run for. That he is peace. That he is love. That he's grace. And that we're going to experience all that in being in a relationship with him. The world just doesn't get that. Do they? They don't understand that. And at this point in Peter's life, I think he's just cracked the lid on that box of beauty and the light is beginning to shine on Peter, I believe he's starting to understand it. But his fear overcomes him. Verse 27, Peter again denied it, and at once a rooster crowed. The third denial. It really is a stunning moment. All four Gospels give us details on this little scene here. And you know what? Peter knows. He's doing the wrong thing. He just can't help himself. His fear and apprehension control him. And let me tell you something. Luke adds a particularly poignant detail to this. In Luke chapter 22, verse 60, he says this, and immediately while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. And in verse 61, it says that Jesus at that point turned and looked at Peter. They made eye contact. They looked intently at each other. What happened? What happened in that moment? Was he looking at Peter going, "Oh, I knew you would do this. You always do this. This is just the way you are, isn't it? This is where you always stumble, Peter." Was Jesus mad? Was he shaking his head in disappointment, going, "Oh, I really had hoped better from you, Peter"? Peter's reactions are pretty well recorded to that moment, that intense look. Matthew and Luke both say he wept bitterly. Mark says that he broke down, literally, that he collapsed and wept. Peter is totally devastated. His fear consumes him. Well, we know about Peter. What about Jesus? What's going on with Jesus? You know, nothing in this chapter shows Jesus as being angry. He's certainly not angry with those who arrested him. After all, he told Peter to put away his sword, and he shed unbelievable grace on Malchus when he healed his ear. So he's not angry at them. He's not angry at the Roman soldiers. He's not resisting. He's not arguing. He's adamant about doing things correctly, but there's nothing wrong with that. He's not belligerent. He's not hostile. He's been patient. He's been compassionate with all those around him, particularly compassionate with the disciples, maybe even more so with Peter. By the time Jesus is in the courtyard, he's acutely aware that Peter has followed him. You can see the commotion going on. Aware that Peter has endangered himself in order to be there. I don't think Jesus feels let down here. Now, that may just be my opinion, but I would take into consideration this if you think it's just my opinion. I don't think Jesus could be disappointed with Peter. You know why? He already told Peter that he would do what he did. He already told Peter that Peter would deny him. Jesus knew that Peter would deny him. Did you hear that? Jesus knew that Peter would deny him three times. He knew exactly what was going to happen. Now, we know that eventually Peter will have the opportunity to make good on those denials three times later. But that's for later on in the Gospel of John. But I want you to consider this. Even as you ponder Peter's situation at this moment where he's made that third denial, Peter is one of the 11. Peter is one of the ones that Jesus has promised protection and provision and inspiration to. Back in the upper room, he told the 11 that he would preserve them, that he would send a comforter, that the comforter would help them and lead them in writing the New Testament. Peter was part of that group. Jesus only speaks the truth. Jesus' prophecies are 100% accurate, and His promises are dependent upon the faithfulness of God, not upon the human frailty of Peter. Promises are dependent upon God and who He is, not upon Peter, even at the darkest moment of his life. God's promises are not dependent upon Peter. What do you think went between Jesus and Peter? I think it was love. I think it was forgiveness. I think it was compassion. I think there was some conviction there, but not in a bad way. Conviction that would reveal unconditional love, a deeper relationship. I think that as that passed between Jesus and Peter, that's what broke Peter. I think this proud, huge, strong, impulsive man came to the full realization that he was incapable of earning the love of his Lord and Savior, that he was totally dependent upon grace. I think Peter got a glimpse of grace. That's what I think Peter saw in Jesus' eyes. Grace. Isn't that the overarching theme of this entire scene? Ever since Jesus washed Judas's feet, he's been demonstrating grace. Grace to Judas. Grace to Malchus. Grace to the Roman soldiers. Grace to Hannas and those who examine him. Yes, that was grace, telling them the truth when they're trying to kill him. Revealing the truth to them. Grace to Peter, who consistently showed aggressive, self-preserving behavior. Grace, self-sacrificing grace from Christ. The great irony, and we know how big John is on ironies, is that the only one in this entire scenario that is worthy of grace is the only one that's dispensing it. The only one worthy of grace is the only one that's dispensing it. And you know what? He's about to show the world the greatest act of grace ever committed. In the history of mankind, he's about to go to the cross for these very people that are betraying him and denying him. See, there's the tension between Christ and Peter. Jesus says, I am. Peter says, I am not. Peter, Peter's us. He's you and me. Peter's a human being who stumbles at times, who fails at times. Peter's a guy that can't make it happen on his own. Peter's just discovered that he can't take control of this situation and fix it. Peter's just discovered that he belongs to a sovereign God who has a plan that will not be interfered by Peter's determination of what's right and what's wrong. Peter's us. Peter's constantly in need of redemption. Peter's constantly in need of grace. And grace flows from Christ in rivers of living water. Praise God. Because each of us in here today are in need of a touch of that grace. We've got three denials, the beginning of a trial. Jesus exhibits nothing but grace throughout. And you watch. You keep an eye on Peter. We've already seen the transformation starting to take place. Peter is going to be changed right before our very eyes. And you know what? He will still stumble from time to time. He's not going to get it right every time. None of us do. But he never surprises Christ. He never blindsides the Lord. He never loses the love of Christ. He never loses the promises that he's been given. You see, that's us too. God's faithfulness to us is not dependent upon our human frailty, but it's dependent on who he is. And even though we may stumble through life, and even though there may be times when we get it wrong, we can't be separated from the love of Christ. We can't be snatched out of his hand. We can't negate the promises of God, because he's God. Let's pray.